P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting you to stop by for Krannert Uncorked, a wine tasting complemented by great music on the first and third Thursday of each month. More information is at KrannertCenter.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. After the Civil War, America faced a new test, putting itself back together. Our guest this afternoon is historian Philip Dre. He is the author most recently of Capital Men, the epic story of Reconstruction through the lives of the first black congressmen. Among these interesting capital men is Congressman Richard Kane of South Carolina. An entrepreneur, he was a champion of making land available to freedmen. Also among them, Representative Robert Brown Elliott of South Carolina. A skilled orator, he called for equal, impartial, and universal liberty. The first in the Senate was Mississippian Hiram Revels. He took the seat once held by Jefferson Davis and was an advocate of amnesty for secessionist leaders. How successful were these and the other capital men? How did they make their way through the promise and then the collapse of Reconstruction? What were the successes and failures of Reconstruction? How did the struggles of Reconstruction provide the groundwork for the civil rights movement that followed the Second World War? What are the echoes of Reconstruction that remain with us today? Those are some of the questions we'll take up this afternoon. Listeners, what questions do you have? I look forward to hearing from you this afternoon. You can join us with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. WILL. Our guest, Philip Dre, is also the author of Stealing God's Thunder and At the Hands of Persons Unknown, The Lynching of Black America. His new book, Capital Men, is published by Houghton Mifflin. Again, the phone number is 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Philip Dre, good to talk with you again. How are you?
Thank you, Celeste. Nice to be here.
Well, let's talk a little bit first about the jacket of your book. It features a reproduction of a Currier and Ives lithograph from 1872, and it depicts the first seven black members of Congress. How are they depicted?
Well, they're depicted in kind of a rather grand style, really. They are all wearing, three-piece suits, and they have pocket watches, and they look like a very distinguished group, really. And it's funny you should ask, because that image was really kind of what launched me on this project. I came upon it, and I was kind of struck by how much these men, some of whom were former slaves, really looked like statesmen. And, I didn't really know much about them, and I was sort of curious about their tenure in Congress during the 10 or 12 years of Reconstruction. And I was also interested when I learned that this lithograph was kind of well known and had been found into the 20th century, still kind of on display in black homes in the South. These men had been role models and heroes to a generation following the Civil War. So that really intrigued me. Not much was known about them, and I was kind of drawn in by that.
Yeah, yeah. How was this lithograph seen at the time by whites?
That's a very good question. I guess it depended where you lived. You know, Reconstruction was a very moment of kind of great idealism and hope, really, early Reconstruction, at least, after the Civil War. It was a time when, of course, we had three constitutional amendments, the 13th, 14th, and 15th, that were enacted in very rapid succession, freeing the slaves, making them citizens of the United States, and granting them, the blacks, the right to vote. And this propelled, you know, very much excited the freedmen, and who, you know, not only were eager to get an education, but also sort of threw themselves into electoral politics. You very soon had as many as 2,000 black elected officials throughout the South. And so this image was very much part, you know, a piece of that era. You know, to African Americans and to their supporters in the North, namely, you know, this would be like Republicans, really, who controlled Congress at that time. This was seen as a very inspiring image and one of, you know, what a lot of people assumed would be part of sort of, you know, literally reconstructed America following the Civil War. In the South, it sort of had the opposite effect. No other issue, probably, more than blacks assuming elected office offended the sensibilities of white Southerners.
Yeah, and that brings to mind one of these white Southerners, Benjamin Pitchfork Tillman.
Oh, yeah, Pitchfork Ben, they called
him. Oh, God.
Well, he was the Ben Tillman was, well, first governor, then later a senator from South Carolina. He was kind of, Ben Tillman was sort of like the prototype for the kind of demagogical, you know, loud Southern diplomat statesman of the 20th century that we sort of came to know in people like Ross Barnett and Orville Faubus and Lester Maddox. Tillman was part of what was known as the straight out movement in the South, which basically what that meant was not only that the white Democrats in the South wanted to rise up against black political influence, they wanted to completely obliterate it, and they took it as a grave insult to the South and an example of what could not be allowed to ever happen again. And so Tillman was instrumental, among many other people, in what's known as redemption, which was the South's rejection of Reconstruction ultimately and the sort of marginalization of black Southerners. Not to a state of slavery, but to a point of sort of invisibility, political invisibility by the turn of the century.
Mm. So this story of Reconstruction, has it been largely deemed a failure owing to these deep divisions in the country? And add on to that the legacy of Jim Crow, things with which we're still grappling with today.
Well, it's interesting. They call it the glorious failure. It has often been thought of as a failure, although this is one thing that kind of intrigued me, which is that, you know, as a historian, nothing can be more interesting than sort of history that's gotten wrong, really. And, you know, this is one of the great myths in American history, the idea that Reconstruction was bad, that it was a terrible thing, and that, you know, the North overstepped its bounds, and it was an example of federal excess, trying to sort of force all sorts of new civil rights and the black franchise on the South, thereby sort of reconstructing it. And as we see, you know, this is the way it's depicted in many, everything from in a birth of a, you know, Birth of a Nation, Gone with the Wind, all sorts of popular books and images. This idea has been perpetuated, even to the point of legitimizing the Ku Klux Klan, which is, of course, initially the way the South reacted to this all. So even in some of these films and books, you even see the Klan as kind of this heroic response, you know, kind of this vigilantism meant to kind of deal with the excessive behavior or misbehavior of now suddenly mobile and powerful black people. So really, this idea existed for almost a century, really, until like the mid-20th century. You basically had, not only in the popular culture, but also among historians, it was very commonly thought that this is what Reconstruction had been. And only within the last half century or so has that idea more or less begun to be reversed and a lot of the positive elements of Reconstruction brought to the fore.
Yeah. Well, one of the many things, one of the things many of us will perhaps remember about this period from our history lessons were, on the one hand, how quickly we moved past it in the books, and also the accounts of corruption. How corrupt was this era, now that you've looked back at it, and what were the capital men up to? Were they corrupt? Were they capable?
Well, it's interesting. They call Reconstruction the era of good stealing. It's a funny thing. It's hard to say because, of course, it was a corrupt time in terms of it was a time of great expansion in America, westward expansion. Corporate power was becoming amassed in a way that would be familiar to us but was sort of unfamiliar to people of the mid-19th century in terms of large railroad trusts, financial institutions. And there was a lot of sort of hand-in-the-glove kind of cooperation with legislatures. The selling of votes was very common. President Grant was involved in, although he personally was never, convicted of anything, his circle was sort of, linked to various scandals involving railroad stocks and this sort of thing. To answer your question, it's hard to say. I sort of feel like even recently we've seen a great deal of political corruption, whether it's from Jack Abramoff or, Randall Cunningham or, it seems to be this sort of constant. In terms of there were a lot of shenanigans, though, back in those days. That's not to dismiss it. Overall, I would say the capital men were probably not as bad as a lot of white politicians. In other words, I don't think there's no record of the black politicians mounting any really major scandal like Crédit Mobilier or the Whiskey Ring. Those were white people doing that. You had some, for instance, there was a man, PBS Pinchback, who was a capital man. He was the lieutenant governor and later the governor of Louisiana, very popular man with a great record on civil rights. He was also kind of a shady dealer in selling public land and that sort of thing, and, made out very well. But like I said, his example is probably the most extreme, and in that he was really no different than a lot of prominent white politicians.
Mm-hmm. So what were the achievements of this era?
Overall, Well, incredible. Really, the world was kind of remade in a sense. I mean, here you had 4 million former slaves suddenly became American citizens soon after they were given the right to vote. You had, for the very first time, a huge federal sort of welfare project known as the Freedmen's Bureau, which set up in the South. Which was really, that would be, again, sort of recognizable in the 20th century, but in the 1860s, that was really something novel. These are mostly federal former Union soldiers serving to all kinds of things, to help negotiate work contracts between former slaves and their former masters, just sort of helping with the kind of unsettled quality of life in the South after the war. So you had like a massive effort like that. You had hundreds or not thousands of missionaries coming into the South, setting up schools for the first time. As I mentioned before, education was a huge priority for both white and black Southerners. So you had this kind of remaking, really, of the country. Various laws, in other words, the Enforcement Acts were passed, guaranteeing democratic government in the South and the protection of the federal government to voters. This was all groundbreaking stuff, and even though it was ultimately all swept away, it did remain on the books, and as you mentioned in your lead-in to our piece, it was a lot of these laws would eventually be revived in the 20th century to sort of provide the foundation for the modern civil rights movement.
Yeah, and we do have the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments.
Of course, yeah.
And that brings me to ask this question about the process of ratification of these amendments. I mean, it happened relatively quickly, 1865, 1868, 1870.
Mm-hmm.
How did this ratification process work, and was it contentious?
It was somewhat contentious, but really the former Confederate states had no choice because they would not be allowed back into the Union unless they ratified these amendments. And so there was some kicking and screaming, of course, but essentially, you know, the handwriting was on the wall. The southern states had been very, you know, much sort of decimated by the war. As much as there was still antagonism, those states were interested in rejoining the Union, and so to do so, the Reconstruction Act set certain ground rules. In addition to ratifying these amendments, they had to hold constitutional conventions, basically rewrite their state conventions to be much more democratic in terms of taxes, the distribution of land, public lands, public education, you know, so those, and even in some cases civil rights statutes guaranteeing equal rights in public accommodations, that sort of thing. So these were very, considering, you know, you had the southern states go from this sort of feudal planter society before the Civil War, suddenly they had sort of like northern-style modern constitutions, which completely kind of tended to reconstruct them.
Yeah. One of the things you write about fairly early in the book is the South Carolina Convention that opened at the outset of 1868. What a fascinating story that is. Tell us about it. What was it like? Who was there?
Well, I use the South Carolina Convention because it was one of the more well-known, but of course all the states, all the southern states had these conventions. You know, it was an incredible scene because you basically had, for the very first time, you had black and white Americans meeting on equal terms to, you know, to, in sort of decision-making forums. And so it was a kind of amazing thing, and spectators kind of watched, you know, goggle-eyed. They didn't know what would happen. They didn't know, you know, very few whites knew black people really at all, except as the most sort of servile types of individuals, doing menial labor or what have you. And so to suddenly behold, you know, black politicians, black elected people who'd been elected to these conventions as delegates, get up and start holding forth about public land policy or the need for public schools was amazing, literally amazing to many people. You know, white northern observers, a lot of northern magazines sent people down to observe this process. And aside from the substance, just the atmospherics were incredible. In other words, you know, they have this expression they use, the African cadences, to describe the way black orators spoke. You know, again, a lot of whites, particularly in the North, had never really heard black people speak their own thoughts. And it was, you know, they were sort of amazed by it, and especially the fact that many black Americans had some tradition in the black church. And, you know, as we all know, there was a kind of a tradition of oratory in the church that lent these politicians a kind of eloquence that sort of, you know, really surprised a lot of white people at how effective they were in a parliamentary setting.
Yeah, and for so many voices to be silenced for so long and then to be loosed.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, of course, there was also the whole kind of truth to power syndrome, I guess you would call it, which is that, you know, suddenly you had black people addressing issues that affected them. And, you know, most whites were, you know, if you were at all a sympathetic listener, you couldn't help but be struck by the sort of foundation of experience from which these people were speaking. I mean, they obviously had a firsthand knowledge, whether they were talking about the Ku Klux Klan or some sort of economic arrangements or the lack of public education. Obviously, they were speaking from a deep sense of both experience and grievance, really. And, you know, as we all know today, that's a very powerful form of public speaking.
Mm-hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, historian Philip Dre. We're talking with him this afternoon about his latest book, Capital Men, the epic story of Reconstruction through the lives of the first black congressman. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free line. That number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, tell us about one of the capital men, one of the men who would be a capital man at the South Carolina Convention, Robert Kane. Who was he and what was his path to office?
Well, you had a lot. South Carolina had the most black congressmen in Reconstruction because, of course, you know, one thing that's important to point out is that there were three southern states, South Carolina, Mississippi, and Louisiana, where blacks had an electoral majority. so that's where you really have this. This whole conflict was sort of fought out very intensely because blacks there were able to, you know, their political might went quite a bit further than it did in other places like, say, Virginia or South or North Carolina, for instance. Richard Kane, they called him Richard Daddy Kane. He had been a prominent minister in Charleston, and basically his, he was sort of known for advocating for land to be made available to the freedmen. This was a major, major issue during Reconstruction. It's kind of famous. Of course, everybody knows the expression 40 acres and a mule. That came from a field order issued by General Sherman of the Union Army in Savannah right toward the end of the war when he gathered together a group of local black ministers and said, "What can we do for you?" And they said, "Well, give us land. That's absolutely what we need." And of course, that made perfect sense. And Sherman said, "Well, all right, we'll, you know, a lot of the southern lands had been sort of abandoned by the owners had fled during the war, what have you. And so there was a lot of sort of ample land available. And Sherman's idea was that the land would be distributed in 40-acre lots. And he even had some mules that sort of worn-out army mules that had come south with his army, and he sort of offered to also distribute these. So that's kind of the origin of that expression. And there were other efforts throughout the South. This idea of, like, land confiscation, essentially, was a very radical idea. It was pushed by several white politicians in Washington, most notoriously Thaddeus Stevens, who's kind of like the Robespierre of American politics of that period, very radical thinker, very powerful senator. But what eventually happened is, though, as the war itself faded, this kind of hot-headed idea, really, of confiscating private property in the South began to seem less attractive to people. It sort of violated the very American sacred notion of property. And so a lot of these plans, even that put forth by General Sherman, were eventually rescinded. And there's all these kind of emotional stories about scenes where federal officers had to go into black communities in sort of impoverished areas and get up and sort of explain, well, that land that we gave you 6 months ago, we're going to have to take it back. Mm. So it was one of the first signs of how Reconstruction, how its idealism would be eventually sort of rolled back.
Yeah, and the failure of that idea of land for the freed slaves, that failure, I guess, maybe it would be safe to say, I hope, accurate to say, you can correct me, that it would eventually lead to the movement of people out of the South, black Americans, the exodusters, and then the Great Migration.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. In other words, a lot of people have pointed to that as one of the critical failures of Reconstruction was that in the post-war South, that the ownership of land would have been gone a long, long way toward establishing the freed slaves as citizens and sort of giving them a kind of an economic grounding. What came in its stead, of course, was the sharecropping system, which is sort of infamous as a way in which black people continued to be sort of exploited by white property owners. There's all these kind of tales of it, working all year for the cotton crop and winding up with, $25 or whatever once the expenses, quote unquote, were subtracted for rental of farm animals and the rake and all, whatever, this kind of thing. And so you're right that after Reconstruction itself had collapsed in the mid-1870s, you began to see a movement of people, really black people, really just out of the South. They headed west. That's the famous exoduster movement. It really crested in about 1879, and their complaint was that, well, we didn't get any land. We're starving as sharecroppers. Meanwhile, the politicians are the black politicians are being sort of driven out of office, and you're taking away our right to vote, which is very sacred or precious to us. So what do we have to stay here for? What's the point? And it set off a huge national debate because, of course, a lot of people, even many black leaders, thought it was a mistake to, like, run away, to not stay in the South. But there was a large movement of people out of the South towards places like Kansas and Oklahoma. It never was as large as people feared. While it was going on, a lot of people thought that the entire South would empty out of African Americans. That never happened, but a large number, at least 20 or 30,000, went to Kansas just in 1879 alone.
Mm. In the North, what was the view of Reconstruction, in particular the ratification of the amendments and the Reconstruction Acts passed by Congress and the state constitutional conventions that were taking place in the South? How did these stories, how were they communicated to Northerners, and how did these stories play in the North?
Well, it's an interesting question. I would say initially there was a great deal of support for a lot of these things, the Reconstruction Acts and the various amendments. There was always, of course, right away there was some trouble in the sort of reform movement itself, in that women who had been a large part of the abolitionist movement felt a little bit cheated by a lot of what happened in Reconstruction. In other words, the women's movement had sort of felt that Reconstruction might literally mean Reconstruction, a much broader kind of Reconstruction, not just a focus on black people's rights, but rather women as well. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of contention when it turned out that the amendments and the various laws that were passed saw to it that black men were given the franchise, but not women. And you had a lot of, there was a kind of a split in the Northern reform movement of women like Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, becoming extremely upset that they had worked so hard for emancipation, and yet now they were educated white women. They were being told they could still not vote, while at the same time, many black men who were illiterate were being enfranchised in the South. And, of course, this was being done partly not for altruistic reasons, but because the Republicans in the North knew that if they didn't enfranchise the Southern blacks, the white Southern representation in Congress would grow much larger because they could claim a much larger resident population. And so it was absolutely necessary that the blacks in the South become registered voters and Republicans, if possible, in order to sort of tip the balance against the Southern Democrats. So there was a lot of sort of back and forth already. But to quickly just answer the rest of your question, in general, I think there was quite a bit of cooperation and idealism. I think after 1870, when you had the 15th Amendment ratified, which granted the franchise, there was a sort of a feeling that, okay, that's it. We've done enough. We've freed these people. We've made them citizens, and now they can vote. They're on their own. We have other things to attend to. There was suddenly a wave of immigration from Europe going on. You had these large financial railroad trusts exerting a lot of power. The labor movement in the North was kind of becoming restless, and so there was a little bit of a sense of, okay, we've reconstructed, now let's get on to something else on the agenda. And particularly when there began to be violence in the South, the Ku Klux Klan, various other kind of white vigilante groups demanding that when there were demands that the federal army go back into the South and restore order, that was a very unpopular idea in the North. The people were sick of the Civil War. They didn't want to start it over again. And so very much there began to be a great impatience among Northerners to sort of put an end to all this reconstructing and just sort of sign off on it.
Were there economic pressures as well in play?
There were. In other words, in 1873, of course, there was a depression, which, of course, then tightened as we're sort of experiencing right now. You see what happens in a circumstance like that. People become much more conservative about what they're willing to outlay and how aggressively they're willing to sort of extend themselves. So yes, you saw that. Also, that put a crimp on the well-being of the cotton economy in the South was hurt, and so it tended to exacerbate tensions there, making life more competitive in the South itself. So you saw the economy there kind of agitate the Southern resistance even more and make the white Southerners, kind of even more eager to what they called redeeming their governments from federal and black influence.
Hmm. Historian Philip Dre is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Our guest's latest book is Capital Men, the epic story of Reconstruction through the lives of the first black congressman. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333 800-288-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now from a listener in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. This is a fascinating discussion, but I did not hear a point of view that Mr. David Inch had a guest to raise a few, well, maybe a month or so ago on his morning 580 show. And I wonder if you've heard of the book written by Douglas A. Blackman. The title of the book is Slavery by Another Name, subtitle, The Re-Enslavement of Black Americans from the Civil War to World War II.
Yes, I am familiar with that.
And he speaks in terms of, not in terms of sharecropper, nor really peonage, but in terms of convict leasing or forced labor involving descendants of slaves, which had the effect, quite frankly, of being a form of neo-slavery. And that lasted from the Civil War to the advent of World War II. And how does that factor into all this liberation coming out of the period we're talking about?
No, that's a very good point. Yeah, the convict, they called it the convict lease system in the South. That was very, you're right, that was very much part definitely an inspiration for a lot of the movement out of the South and the frustration. What happened in the South after the Civil War was that, whereas in the North, penitentiaries were being built, there was kind of an advent of a system, of a sort of a more modern system of imprisoning people, if you will. The South didn't do that, and so they tended to lean more on sort of more ad hoc methods of you know, turning people into convicts, basically. And because the Southern states were impoverished, they hit upon the idea of actually profiting from convict labor by then leasing out their convicts to private interests, whether it's railroad or some large agricultural interest, that sort of thing.
And mining also.
Mining. And it was a very cynical and nefarious process. And what would happen often is that, you know, you could go into that system for some very minor transgression or crime and, you know, spend the next 5 or 10 years as a convict laborer. So, yes, that's a very good point. That was a terrible kind of a persistent syndrome. Of course, it's represented by the chain gang. We all sort of have that image, which right. did last into the 20th century.
Right. And in some ways, as I read Mr. Blackman's book and listen to his program with Mr. Inge, this was more difficult in many instances than the actual institution of slavery, because the people who purchased the services of the convict leasing really had no proprietary interest in these people other than to work them to death,
mm-hmm.
whereby slave owners in the South had a proprietary interest that they sort of showed some mercy toward, just to make sure that interest, that property interest, was protected.
Well, that's a very good point. And that's a kind of a minor thing about Reconstruction, but it seems to be true, is that when things would go very poorly and get really ugly for the freedmen, there was always this kind of hearkening back to the days of slavery, in that there at least you had a kind of, in other words, the authority figures could be at least somewhat benign, in that because the slaves were valuable property, they might be afforded a certain attention that otherwise, just as free citizens, obviously, they were left to fend for themselves.
Right. All right, but thank you.
Thank you a lot for the call.
Thank you very much for the call. Other questions, comments are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest this afternoon, Philip Dre, author of Capital Men, The Epic Story of Reconstruction Through the Lives of the First Black Congressman. We haven't talked too much about individuals. Before we run out of time, I want you to tell us about a particular story you found fascinating, a particular character in this story of these congressmen, both in the House and Senate.
Well, one of my favorites, and I think an extremely impressive man, was Robert Smalls, who was a slave in Charleston at the outbreak of the Civil War. He worked on the waterfront, and he connived with several other slaves to steal a Confederate boat. And they stole a boat in the middle of the night and delivered it to the Union blockade off the South Carolina coast. Well, for this, Robert Smalls overnight became a war hero, really. In fact, he was one of the first war heroes that the North had. This was very early in the war. It was in the summer of 1862, at a time when things hadn't really been going all that well for the Federal forces. So suddenly they had this slave who had sort of become, his picture appeared in Northern magazines. He was quoted at length. They brought him to Washington to help lobby for the cause of having black men serve in the Union Army. And, of course, he was a very effective advocate, because anybody who questioned whether slaves could be turned into soldiers, or if they were resourceful or courageous enough to do so, had this living example in this man, Robert Smalls. And he met with President Lincoln, various other people who at one point had been very dubious about this. But so Smalls is kind of an important figure. He helped to kind of put over this argument, which of course he won, that black men and former slaves should be allowed in the Union forces. And almost 200,000 served in the Federal Army during the Civil War. They fought in many battles, and about 40,000 lost their lives. Smalls himself then went on to become a congressman, and because he came from the Sea Islands of South Carolina, which was a very large black area, he was able to hold on to his constituency much longer than a lot of other black congressmen, and he wound up being an important figure really into the early 20th century in the Sea Islands because of this kind of as much as the whites tried to gerrymander him out of office, mm-hmm. they could never quite do it, and he held on to power. And he's, even to this day, he's kind of a local legend down there.
How long did he serve in Congress?
He served until, I believe, about the late 1880s, when they finally managed to oust him. You know, after 1877, South Carolina reverted to white rule, and there was an effort to drive blacks out of political office and their white friends as well, any white Republicans also. So Smalls kind of retreated to the Sea Islands, and he did hold on much longer than a lot of other black politicians of the era did. But eventually, he lost office. He then, like a lot of these men, he kind of survived on federal patronage then for the rest of his life. He was made, I believe, a customs inspector in Beaufort, South Carolina.
Yeah, he served until 1887. He went on to live until 1915.
I mean, many of these men had rather sad endings, really, yeah. considering how high they had reached. Someone like Robert Brown Elliott was a great orator, and in Congress gave a famous speech about civil rights that was, you know, he was an Obama-like person, and he was very charismatic, and he had a sort of a devoted following, and big lithographs of him were printed and distributed. But, you know, he wound up penniless. He died in his 40s in a pauper in New Orleans, sort of forgotten. He couldn't find work really anywhere. And so dramatic was the reversal in the fortunes of blacks generally during that period, and also specifically blacks who had risen to power during Reconstruction.
Mm. Well, now this gets us nicely to Reconstruction's echoes, the echoes of Reconstruction. And you say they resonate still. The elections of 2000 and 2004, you mentioned in your preface, and now we have, you just mentioned Barack Obama. He was only the third African American to serve in the U.S. Senate since Reconstruction. So what are your thoughts on his campaign and election?
Well, of course, it's been very interesting. You know, I guess one of my first thoughts is that, you know, there was a long period from the time of Reconstruction when you had a lot of black elected officials up until the present day. There was kind of a very long period when a lot of black leadership was not really in politics. It was in other things. It was in the church. It might be in some sort of cause like Marcus Garvey, Malcolm X. Obviously, someone like Martin Luther King was a churchman. And so recently now, with Obama, with Deval Patrick up in Massachusetts, Cory Booker in Newark, and various other black, you see like a return of black politicians, many of whom are supported by white voters. And this is a kind of relatively new phenomenon, and you'd almost have to go all the way back to Reconstruction to find something comparable. In terms of Reconstruction generally, yeah, I think it's, you know, as we said before at the top of the interview, it's the laws that were put in place were never really you know, scrubbed away. They just were sort of put up in the nation's attic and put in a trunk. Mm. But when they were taken out again, they were found to be perfectly serviceable. And so you had a lot of the civil rights legislation of the mid-20th century, like the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 65. Those were basically just sort of refurbished pieces of legislation from, you know, 80 or 90 years before, which hadn't stuck the first time. Mm. And so we're sort of brought back into play. But the elections you mentioned, 2000, 2004, and we see this even in the most recent election, you know, a lot of the kind of ballot box trickery and the kind of intimidation that's tried or is even as effective, you know, this is stuff that was going on in the South during Reconstruction and all during the late 19th century when whites were very successful at basically suppressing black voting altogether. And so that's why African Americans become especially sensitive in our day when we hear about these kind of attempts to interfere with the franchise, because it goes right back to a very bitter experience in their past of seeing the vote essentially taken away from them in the South in the years around, you know, during the kind of onset of Jim Crow in the late 19th century.
Mm. Earlier you mentioned women and women's suffrage and that fight, and I was thinking at the time of Shirley Chisholm when you were talking about that, and now I'm thinking of her again as you mentioned, you know, so much stuff sat on the shelf for so long. She was elected to Congress in 1969. She was the first black woman to be elected to Congress, and she served quite a number of years and ran for president.
That's right. Well, Shirley Chisholm was a remarkable character. Of course, she came out of Brooklyn here, Brooklyn, New York. She was an example of someone who, of course, and we saw this, she was like a kind of a prototype in a way, but there was in the late 20th century, of course, this the propensity of sort of urban political machines to produce powerful black figures like Adam Clayton Powell, Shirley Chisholm, Harold Washington in Chicago, this kind of thing. And, yeah, she was an amazing figure and is still considered very sort of revered here in Brooklyn where I live. And, yeah, she was kind of ahead of her time in a way. I think she would be very immensely pleased to see what's gone on here recently.
Yeah, I wonder about the Capitol men, too.
I know. I can't. Well, of course, let's face it, even many of us are still kind of trying to get over it. You know, it's been an amazing election, really. Yeah, for them, I mean, you know, the Capitol men, every time they would come to Washington, they'd have to, like, run some sort of gauntlet of the Ku Klux Klan, or on the trains they couldn't get service, you know, this kind of thing. So, you know, their lives were lived. They were like hunted, haunted people despite their positions in Congress. So to them, the idea of Obama would, you know, just completely dazzle and amaze them. Although in one way, to be fair to them, they wouldn't be too surprised, because they always felt very much the measure of any of the whites they served with, and they tended to prove it, really.
Mm. What do you hope readers will take away from this book? Is there anything in particular you have in mind?
I guess the thing that I was most amazed at when I researched and wrote the book, and I hope people would take away from it, was how the kind of like loyalty and devotion to country that a lot of these people had, which was kind of incredible considering what they had gone through. In other words, after 300 or whatever it was, plus years of slavery, for this group of people to kind of emerge sort of full-blown into American society and be really kind of keen on it, like eager to learn, whether it was just learning how to read their own Bible, or, you know, the schools in the South were packed after the Civil War with people of all ages wanting desperately to learn how to read. And then you had this political engagement as well, people very eager to serve, to vote. You know, blacks in the South would endure day-long lines at that time just to register to vote. It was this compulsion. And it's a sort of amazing feature of American life in a way, and a real testament, really, to the African-American experience, I think. This kind of just, like, determination to become Americans, to insist they were Americans, and to sort of lay claim to it. And, of course, the disappointment when that was sort of, when the offer was kind of withdrawn, so to speak, was really immense.
Mm. We only have about 2 minutes left. I've got one caller waiting, so let's take this call. Listener in Champaign on line one, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'm curious. I grew up in Massachusetts and remember my first racial, anti-racial lesson being from my dad, who voted for Edward Brooke and said, you know, you really can't tell anything about a person from the outside, honey, and then he cast his vote. How did he get other support, however, in a state that has a lot of Irish Americans who weren't amazingly supportive of blacks? I'm going to hang up and listen to the last minute or two.
Okay, thanks for the call.
You know, to be perfectly honest, I don't know a whole lot about Edward Brooke. The only thing I do know about him is, though, that he was a rather conservative. He was a Republican, for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't a Democrat coming out of, I believe, Massachusetts at that time was largely Democratic state. So my sense of him was always that he kind of appealed to a conservative element in the state as well, and that that might explain how he managed to get into office. I also suspect that he also came through some sort of political, a political machine in Massachusetts was sort of responsible for putting him in that position. He must have been elected, I guess, in the mid-1950s or so.
1967.
Oh, he wasn't elected till 67.
His term was 1967 to 1979.
Okay, well then
that's what he served.
You've caught me a little flat-footed. I don't know that much about him.
No, not at all. You've done just a marvelous job, and it's such a wonderful book. But in order to prepare, there were so many names. It's such a wonderful book, and there's so many wonderful stories. But I needed kind of a scorecard, so
I know.
Prepped up, a list of things. So, yeah,
no, that was one of the challenges of writing the book. I found was that you didn't really want to exclude anybody. On the other hand, you can't throw too many characters at the reader. I tend to focus on just five or six of them
mm-hmm.
who are the most prominent and or colorful.
Yeah, yeah. And also it's not a, straight down the line narrative. It's woven very, very skillfully.
Well, thanks. It was hard because you had things happening in various places,
mm-hmm.
sometimes simultaneously, but sometimes not. And so because Reconstruction moved forward and was rolled back, the schedules kind of varied. It was difficult to calibrate it. But yeah, I was pleased with the result too.
Mm. Philip Dray, thank you very much for talking with us this
Thanks
afternoon.
A lot, Celeste.
Philip Dray is the author, most recently, of Capital Men, the epic story of Reconstruction through the lives of the first black congressman. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin. It's 1:53 Central Time. Let's find out what happened today in Kansas City and in Chicago. Here with our settlement prices, Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. Let's take a look at those numbers. We'll start actually with the Dow Jones Industrial Average because that was what led the market down a lot yesterday. It stabilized somewhat today, and the outside market is now trading that Dow. This is a 15-minute delayed quote, just 77 points higher at 82.26. That has stabilized a bit the commodity markets, but finished most of those markets lower for the day. Nearby wheat futures were unchanged with a high of 519.75 in Chicago, the low at 504.5, a settlement price for the soft red winter wheat lead option at 509.75, unchanged on the day. The March of 538 high, low at 522. Settlement price there, a half cent higher at 528.5, and May futures in the wheat pit. 551 the high, the low at 36.5, a settlement price at 542.25, up a half. July contract, this is next year's harvest month, 564 the high, the low at 549.75. July in the soft red at 555.5, up 0.75 for the day. December Kansas City wheat, 1.75 the gain at 537.5, and December spring wheat at 590 in Minneapolis at the grain exchange, 11.5 cents higher today, 590 the settlement price there. But the following month, the March, up 3.5 cents at 591.5. From the corn pit back in Chicago, nearby contract, that's the December, the harvest month for this year, 338 on the high. Low at 330, settlement price at $3.32.5, up 0.25 cents. March futures, 354, the high, the low at 345. Settlement price at 348.25, down 0.5. And the May futures, 365, the high, the low at 356.75. Settlement price at 359.5, down 0.5. You know that December contract was off 0.25, not up 0.25 in the lead option. July futures, 375.5 the high, the low at 367.75. Settlement price at $3.70, down 0.75. In September futures, 385.5 the high, the low at 79.25. Settlement price at $3.80, down 0.75. Next year's December futures, $4.75 the high, low at 393.75. Settlement price at 395, 0.25 lower for the December 2009 corn contract. December oats gained 4.5 cents today to settle 206.5, the high at 212.75, the low at 2 bucks even. December oats, 206.5, a settlement price 4.5 higher. March up 4.5 as well at $2.22. From the soy complex, nearby contract 857.25 the high, the low at 826. The January settled $8.27, 19 cents lower on the day. March at 865.75 high, low at 833.25. Settlement price at 834.5, down 19.75 cents. And the May futures from the bean pit in Chicago, 873.25 the high, the low at 843. May soybean settled $8.44, down 19.75. July futures, 8.85, the high, the low at 52.5, a settlement price at $8.53, down 19.5 cents. November beans, 8.87.75, the high, the low at 55.75. November settled 8.56, down 19.75. December bean meal futures, 2.54, the high, low at $245.20, settlement price at $246.10, down $6.20. January bean meal down 5.20 at $245.30. December bean oil 31.50 the high, the low at 30.45. Settlement price at 30.42, down 69. And January futures down 63 at 30.77 for the soybean oil. During today's edition of the Closing Mark Report on the second day of December, the final crop progress report of the season from Iowa. They are now 95% complete harvested for their corn. We'll hear more from them during the Closing Market Report at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Let's turn our attention now to what happened in Chicago at the Mercantile Exchange with the livestock contracts. Another lower day today. December live cattle, 85.90 the high, 84.15 the low, 84.35 the settlement, that down 1.10. February, 86.30 the high, 84.70 the low, 84.95 the settlement, that down 77.5. April, 88.05 the high, 86.45 the low, 86.52.5 the settlement, that down 102.5. June live cattle, 83.75 the high, 82.45 the low, 82.50 the settlement, that down 62.5. January feeder cattle, 90.47.5 the high, 88.50 the low, 89 even the settlement, that down 62.5. March, 90.45 the high, 88.70 the low, the settlement 89.10 down 75. April feeder cattle 91 even the high, 89.60 the low, the settlement 89.97.5 that down 50. May feeder cattle 91.70 the high, 90.15 the low, finishing at 90.90 down 30. December lean hogs 58.90 the high, the low 58.25, the settlement 58.37.5 that down 35. February 66 even the high, 65.05 the low, the settlement 65.47.5 that finished up 12.5. April lean hogs 72.95 the high, 72.05 the low, 72.15 the settlement, that down 25. May 80.62.5 the high, the low 79.90, the settlement 80.20 down 42.5. And February pork bellies were off a dime today, the high 92.30, the low 91.10, the settlement 92.12.5. Again, that was down 10. The Dow currently up 117 points at 82.66. The NASDAQ is up 29 points at 14.27. The S&P 500 up 17 at 8.34. Crude oil in New York trading down 2.43. The nearby month at 46.85. It's 2 o'clock. This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urban.